Time now for Labor Press's Blue Collar Buzz, your source for daily labor news and industry information. Hear discussions on the workplace and interesting talk from prominent and influential personalities in the labor community. And now your hosts, Bill Holfeld and Joe Maniscalco.
Accountability.
Hello and welcome to Labor Press's Blue Collar Buzz, the show that tells the story of everyday workers, talks a little bit about their struggles, and hopefully even more about their victories. I'm your host, Bill Holfeld. In the studio with me is my co-host and producer, Joe Maniscalco. And Joe, how are you today?
Pretty good, Bill. Good to see you again.
Okay, I got to make one real quick editorial comment before we dive in.
You bet.
Okay, I have had it with people that have earbuds in their ear and walking along the street talking to other people on the telephone. And they look like they're crazy homeless people talking to themselves. If you're out there and you have an earbud in your ear and you're walking down the block and you're talking to yourself, stop right now because you look stupid.
Unless
okay.
You're listening to Blue Collar Buzz.
Okay.
Turn it up.
That's my editorial comment for the day. Now I'll throw it back over to you, Joe. Joe, who do we have on the program today?
I want everybody to stay tuned because we have an extra special show. We have a lot going on. We're going to be speaking to two striking Spectrum workers from IBEW Local 3 to talk about what it's been like to be on strike for 10 months now. And we're also going to speak to Mike Halpin. He's an organizer with International Union of Elevator Constructors Local 1. So talk about the ongoing debts in the construction industry here in New York City. And we're also going to speak to our first guest, who is Eric Dean. He is the president of the International Association of Bridge Structural and Ornamental and Reinforcing Ironworkers Union.
Eric, welcome back to the program.
Great to talk to you guys.
And I understand that very recently, you received an award for something that's pretty groundbreaking in the building trades. And so why don't you jump right in and tell us about that, please?
Last year, the Ironworkers Union, along with its contractor partners through our labor management program, initiated a first-of-its-kind maternity benefit for our incumbent members in hopes of protecting female members who have to battle through pregnancy and the heavy tasks of doing on-the-job work. So we provided a mechanism to take care of the sisters who become pregnant and are eligible for that benefit. But we also did it to be more inclusive and to be able to go to career fairs and show people that the ironworkers are leading the way. And ENR has blessed, I guess, me, but I will tell you that it's a total team effort with ENR top 25 newsmakers. So it's a good feather in the cap for our organization. I guess I get far more credit and not enough blame when things go wrong. But I'm going to get to come up to New York City and attend a gala and be able to tell our story.
Well, that's happening in April, right, Eric?
Yes, sir.
That's great. And you know that Labor Press will be there to cover that event.
Looking forward to it.
That's for certain. So, you know, one of the things I found very interesting is when you started out is telling us about this is that it was very much a product of a labor management initiative. And talk about that a little bit, if you would, because I think far too often people who are not familiar with the union movement see labor and management as constant adversaries. And I know the ironworkers have made such great progress with this that that's not the case at all. So go into that a little bit, if you would.
We have a labor management program. Its acronym is IMPACT, for the Ironworkers Management Progressive Active Cooperative Trust. And together, we work on joint issues from curriculum development, business development, and any initiatives that's good for both the employer and the union. And it's a jointly trusted decision-making board. And everything we do, the employers and the union agree on about 85-90% of most issues. Sometimes we difference over splitting up profits, and we're politically motivated slightly different. But 90% of what we work on is a collaborative effort. So in or about 2003, we started the Joint Labor Management Program, and we meet 3-4 times a year. We carved two countries up into 13 regions, and you actually meet informally, have a little sandwich, and you meet with the employers, and you discuss the ongoing issues rather than just at the collective bargaining time where things are adversarial. And you come up with solutions to and initiatives that benefit the industry. And this was just one of many that we do there. But, yeah, people are always shocked when we show up and we go arm in arm with some of our nation's largest employers. And the owners and the elected officials, they don't know how to act when we're on the same side of various issues.
And explain to us, Eric, why this is such a win-win. And, I mean, I know for a fact that it is, but make that clear to people who don't understand why this is such a win-win scenario.
Well, you take the initiative of just even how we train workers. Our money comes from jointly labor-managed trust training funds, and the contractors put their spin of professionalism and what the industry needs, as well as the ironworkers do. And when we have programs like Impact, we're able to fund our national training fund, which provides all the curriculum to retrain the next generation of ironworkers and future ironworkers. And I will tell you, that curriculum is cutting edge. It's electronic delivery. And without everyone putting their shoulder to the wheel and coming up with that collective, you don't come up with these ideas. Our newest initiative is to retrain mid-level management to be successor folks within contracting groups, because the ironworkers don't have anywhere to go if that older contractor shuts his business down. So we've come up with so many creative initiatives where we meet together and we decide what we can do, and everything's on a majority rule democratic process, and some things are contractor-driven initiatives, some things are labor-driven initiatives, but most, like when you invest in new welding laboratories across the United States and Canada, we took on that investment because we wanted the air quality, but the contractors need a bigger supply of certified welders. So it wins for the employer, and it wins for the worker training of the members of our union that have state-of-the-art welding labs. And that's just one small example.
And that's a great example. And you know, you talk about training. When we talk about training, we're not just talking about training people in the actual technical skills. What's most amazing about the instructor training program is how much emphasis is put on how to teach, because not everybody's a natural born teacher. So you got lots of guys out there and gals who have lots of great technical skills and they want to pass it on to the next generation, but they need some help in learning how to go about passing that on. And that's part of what you offer.
Well, one of the things or initiatives that we work on, which you're familiar with because I used to see you there, is we have an annual train the trainer program where we don't take for granted that the best trained ironworker knows how to impart or transfer that knowledge. So we hire college-level professors who teach teaching and instruction techniques. And all of this, while that's a sub-trust with the National Training Fund, it's all born out of the impact contributions and the employers and the national union officials see that vision of how do you make that school and how many instructors are retiring, how do we get that next wave. And so we get the best teaching techniques, and we go to Ann Arbor, Michigan, and we use several colleges, and we teach folks on how to be welding inspectors, how to do basic vocational instruction, how to be more organized and lesson plan. And all that takes, A, little grundle of money, and B, a collective vision. Because if you leave it to regions, you'll have regions who succeed and others who get left behind. And what we try and do is paint with a brush across the United States and Canada, so we have really good best practices and uniformity. We spend $90 million in aggregate just from the ironworking industry alone annually on training.
And you know, Eric, this is another great example. Just as you were out front, you know, with the maternity leave issue, I don't think people realize how long this type of training has been going on within the ironworkers. If I'm not mistaken, we just had the 33rd, was it not?
I knew it was in the 30s. I'm glad you knew the exact number, because I, you know, one year melds to the next, and I hate to be disconnected to the facts. But yeah, I knew it was in the over 30. So, yeah.
So for 33 years now, the ironworkers have been the point men, if you will, on training the next generation. education so that those skills and that institutional knowledge and institutional memory does not go away.
I write a monthly letter in our journal to our members and to the industry stakeholders. And part of it was each individual's responsibility to mentor on the job, and then the various folks that need to mentor our next generation of supervisors and labor leaders, but the all-important role of those training communities and the instructors about transferring the knowledge, because there's a large amount of baby boomers leaving, so there is a large influx of people to take their place, and you got to transfer and impart a whole lot of knowledge in a short period of time as skillfully and adeptly as possible.
Eric, we've got about 30 seconds left, so before we leave off, tell us, if you had a magic wand and you could make what you wanted to happen next, what would be the next issue you would tackle now that you've got this maternity thing in the bag?
A $1 trillion infrastructure bill, as promised.
Okay, I think you'd get a lot of support on from people from all walks of life and all sectors of industry. I know just getting to work in the morning sometimes is a challenge. Although I have to admit, thanks to all the well trained ironworkers, that Tappan Zee Bridge that I cross all the time is coming along just fine.
It looks good. It makes my heart swell with pride when I get to see or drive across it. So
it's a beautiful day. Eric, I want to thank you so much for being so generous with your time and being as effective a leader as you are, really, because you're always out in front and you're always looking for the best for your members and for your contractors. And sometimes that's a tough job. And I just want to take a second to recognize that and say thank you.
Bill and Joe, thank you. Thank all your listeners.
Okay. Have a great day now.
Bye-bye.
And we will be back right here on Labor Press's Blue Collar Buzz at AM 970, The Answer.
You're listening to Labor Press on AM 970, The Answer. You have labor questions? They have answers. Bill Hohlfeld and Joe Maniscalco, Labor Press's Blue Collar Buzz.
And we're back with more good talk right here on Labor Press's Blue Collar Buzz at AM 970, The Answer. I'm your host, Bill Hohlfeld, and in the studio with me is my co-host and producer, Joe Maniscalco. You know, Joe, it's been really nice that Eric has been generous enough to come on the air a couple of times with us now, and it just always amazes me, because I don't think most people connect, when you think of any of the trades, you don't connect the ironworkers with being some of the most progressive among them, and what they're doing with education, you know, equal treatment for females and that type of thing. It's just it's a good thing.
Well, I people remember that Eric was on the show last year talking about the program, how it actually started was with a fortunate ironworker who had a miscarriage. Because she didn't have maternity leave, so hopefully this changes things.
And sometimes all you need to change things is somebody that has the desire and the political will to do the right thing, huh?
Well, we're going to talk about a bunch of people right now that have tons of desire. They're part of the new Pathways to Apprenticeship program, and we have the board member and co-founder with us, Melissa Shetler, and we also have a graduate of the program and somebody else who's in the program right now. We have Shai Green and Alice Fuentes on the show.
That's terrific. Melissa, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
It's so nice to see you again.
Nice to see you, too.
And so tell us now, you're one of the co-founders, so, you know, tell us what got this off the ground. Give us a little background in Genesis.
Yeah, so I was working actually at the time with the laborers, and this was a project born out of a bunch of people who just kind of wanted to do the right thing. We were working with the Osborne Association and folks coming out of prison and trying to get good careers and put their lives back together. And that was just the genesis of it. We expanded it to work with all sorts of community groups moving from that point on. But, you know, we really understood that the trades are open to folks, but it's a difficult process to navigate. Right? So we were navigating the apprenticeship application process, that whole online, waiting in line, et cetera. And we realized we got really good at it, and we helped people really understand the trades and which trade they wanted. Apprenticeship costs a lot of money for both the contractor and the unions. You want to make sure you have people people that know what they're getting into. So we created a 501c3 and decided to go for the Department of Labor direct entry status, which we now have. And the program has gone from this little gem of a concept and 10 people to we've now graduated 142 people into apprenticeship. And this first class in Westchester, who one of our guests here, Alex, graduated from, is the first of its kind in Westchester County.
You know, Melissa, before we go any further, I got to tell you, you really pluck a heartstring here with me, because I have always said that there are lots of different organizations that want to do a lot of good things for people, but it's always been my personal belief that when you get people good jobs, 80% of those other problems seem to manage to go away almost by themselves.
I absolutely agree. Years and years ago, I was an after-school teacher, and I saw that parents couldn't come watch their kids do performances because they were working double, triple jobs just to make ends meet. Give someone a career, and you give them access to, like, a real, real pathway for a middle-class life and a de-stress and a lot of things just disappear.
Well, Bill, Shai Green went through the program, and she's on the pathway to success right now. Shai.
Yes, I am.
Shai, welcome to the program. So, tell us a little bit about your personal journey.
Okay, so my personal journey is funny. Like Melissa just mentioned, my prior job before this one, I actually got fired. I was working at a non-union plumbing company. I was the office manager there, and I got fired because I could not get my kids out of school on time. So it became an issue with, you know, child care and having someone pick them up and get them there too late and them charging me. And I already couldn't afford just the child care alone and then the late fees. So I ended up having to, you know, I got in trouble with work and I left my job. So then around that same time, a friend of mine who actually my at the same daycare that my child was at, there was a woman there and she was in Local 79 and she was, you know, I was telling her about my stresses and different things like that. And she told me that I should try, and the apprenticeship was like right around the corner. So the day came, I signed up, I went through the process. My life has been changed like completely ever since then. I've turned 30 this year. I'm buying my first house. My kids have their own room for the first time. I went to the Bahamas for my 30th birthday with my kids. I'm taking my daughter to Puerto Rico for her 13th birthday next month. So it's just been definitely a life-changing event for me. And now I'm actually a mentor. So I have 10 current mentees. So I speak with them every Sunday. Anything that I'm learning at work or that I know, I take pictures of it. I send it to them just to make, you know, their process a little easier than mine was, you know, when nobody wants to help.
That's the American dream brought to you by organized labor.
There you go.
Right.
But, you know, hey, and good for you for making the extra effort to pay it forward.
Yes,
because
definitely.
That's really what it's about. And that's
right.
You know,
I'm actually on my way to a rally, to the Count Me In rally at 3 o'clock with my mentees. I have them meet me there every Thursday. I'm sorry, every Tuesday at 3 and every Thursday morning at 6 a.m. And we're out there every single week.
Okay, so just let me say this, you know, because way too often, you know, unions get wrapped for being filled with people that don't want to work. It's not that
right.
Filled with people that don't want to work. We're filled with people who want to work together.
Right.
Yeah.
Right, and we have to fight for those jobs.
Yeah, unfortunately, but that's always been the way. Good for you, Shai. Shai, hold on, don't go away. But let's bring Alex into the conversation now. Alex, are you out there?
Yeah.
And so you're an active member of the program now. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. Like Melissa, you know, was saying before, you know, she came into our community and she kind of find me, and now it's good that I'm part of B2A, and also it's kind of changing my life because, I mean, we're kind of, you know, looking for an opportunity to you know, to do better, in, you know, better in our lives. And it's good, you know, to have people who is, you know, helping us kind of changing the way that we live, the way that we think, and the way that we really, you know, do things and kind of, you know, fighting for those jobs that are there, like, you know, waiting for people like us, you know, to do it. It's amazing how they are kind of putting all this together and working with the union.
Now, Alex, let me ask you a question. You said something that I thought was very interesting about changing the way you think. And tell me what you mean by that, because that's an interesting comment. How do you mean changing the way you think?
Well, I mean, like, right now I was working with non-union company, and I thought that, you know, I was getting really good pay, but, you know, the way that, you know, they saying is that, you know, all those jobs that they giving away for just a little money, and now that I see that all the money that, you know, they are making is like, I mean, now it's, I just not making enough money for all the money that they just, you know, making for their own. So it's like, now they have like, you know, that big amount of money that they not want to give it away, you know, to people like me who is doing the, you know, the real job. And it's amazing how, you know, they working with that. And how Melissa was explaining to us one day is like, you know, people who wanted to develop towns and cities and that the way that they have the money and the way that we have the power to create all those jobs for us, it's amazing. That's how, you know, it's changing my you know, the way that I see the things, that, you know, how they working now.
Yeah, well, there's a very old poster, Alex, that says labor creates all wealth, and I've always been pretty much tuned into that.
Well, listen, what I thought was very interesting, what Alex said, is that you actually found him. Usually, it's a lot of this is word of mouth. Somebody hears, has a friend, hears that there's a test opening up. You actually talk about that. You're actually seeking people out.
Yeah, I mean, so part of my other role as the director of organizing with Local 46 is to do labor community partnership work. And we've been looking a lot in Westchester County. You have a lot of development in New Rochelle and Yonkers and huge developers historically from the city going up and developing this area. And we just want to make sure that the community benefits and that the work is career-based and not just short-term jobs with a broom for a few weeks and you don't have any skill afterwards that, you know, you can take on. And it makes my heart really warm to hear Alex, you know, my organizing side come out in Alex, right? This idea of community power and coming together is really what the labor unions are about.
And wouldn't that kind of outreach really benefit everyone? Because, Bill, we always hear now that the pipeline, you know, all of this is contingent. The amount of, you know, union jobs that we have is all contingent on them being available. You know, so in the 30 seconds we have, can you talk about how we can grow the push, put pressure on government with more apprentices?
I would love to. So we have this great new county executive in Westchester, Latimer, right, who came in and unseated a Republican. There's a lot of money in the IDA, in the EDC, our tax dollars, our union pension funds invested in this work. So, you know, we need to be at the table. We need to come together as workers, and we also need to look at our funds and put pressure on them to understand that this needs to come back to the community.
And we do need to be at the table, and I'll tell you somewhere else, Melissa, you need to be here in the studio more often. So we're going to have you back, and you're going to keep us posted on what kind of progress this program makes, because we want to know.
My pleasure.
Shia, thank you so much for being there and for paying it forward. And Alex, good luck to you as you go forward. And with that, we're going to break it off here, and we will be back in just a second with more good talk right here on Labor Press's Blue Collar Buzz at AM 970. The Answer.
You're listening to Labor Press on AM 970, The Answer. And now back to Labor Press's Blue Collar Buzz with your hosts, Bill Holfeld and Joe Maniscalco.
And we're back with more good talk right here on Labor Press's Blue Collar Buzz. I'm your host, Bill Holfeld. And my co-host and producer, Joe Maniscalco, is in the studio with me today. Joe, before we forget, I don't think we reminded anybody, how do people find us on social media, Joe?
Yeah, definitely. Please follow us on Twitter at LaborPressNY. You can write to us directly at bcb@laborpress.org. Definitely log on to laborpress.org for daily news. And also find us on Facebook.
And from what I understand, I got to talk to you more about it later. We got some interesting feedback on Facebook about the Year of the Rank and File editorial. Is that correct?
Yeah, we're definitely making inroads. And in the coming weeks, we'll be making a lot more exciting announcements. So we're definitely raising our profile.
There you go. And just in case there's a mystery out there, what we have done here at Labor Press is we have declared this the year of the rank and file. Okay, that's who we're about. That's what we're about. And Joe, what kind of rank and file are we talking about next?
We got rank and file that have been out on strike for 10 months now against Charter Spectrum. We have two IBEW Local 3 workers. We have John Freeman and Randy Cedeno. And guys, welcome to the studio.
Yeah. How you doing?
Welcome to the program, fellas. Now, what is it, 10 months you're out now?
Yes.
10 months. Let's cut right to the chase, fellas. What's the real issue here?
Real issue is we want our benefits package. We want to keep intact what we fought for the past 40 years. And they're trying to offer us their company-sponsored benefit package, which is not in our best interest.
So just to be clear here, there's nobody here that's asking for any kind of huge or crazy increase. All you're asking is that you held on to what it was that you have had for this many years when Spectrum bought you out.
The word wage was never even uttered.
Okay.
It was not even a thought.
And tell us about what kind of cuts they're talking about.
Well, they're talking about the actual package they want to give us, so-called wage-rich package, consists of it's a premium of $400. This is the premium plan, $400 per month. And then there's a $3,000 deductible. And then after that, you're still on the hook for another 10%.
Okay. So
where my package that I currently have now, I pay my dues, my monthly dues, and all I pay is a minimal copayment.
Okay. And why? Well, I know why. It's corporate greed. But what has been the big block? I mean, why can't we get to the table here? Why can't a compromise be reached?
It just seems that Charter doesn't want to compromise. It's their way or the highway. The union is trying to give concessions. They're trying to bend over backwards to get us back to work. They just simply do not want a deal.
So concessions have been offered.
You've said, yes.
Yeah.
Well, just in the last one was December.
December. Mm-hmm. Randy, what's your take on this?
Well, back in December when they went to the negotiating table, our business rep, Chris Erickson, he had made many concessions, like John was saying. But from day one, Charter's stance was this is a take-it-or-leave-it offer. Anytime we have gone to the table, they have refused to talk about anything. I think the longest any meetings have lasted is 15, 20 minutes before the disrespect is seen. I mean, we live in New York City. You know, we're supposed to be negotiating in good faith. And this company just wants to break the union. That's really all they care about.
It sounds pretty obvious. But now, correct me if I'm wrong, but didn't Spectrum just get like this huge city contract? And that part of getting this city contract was that they were supposed to uphold wages and conditions? Wasn't that part of the terms of them getting the contract?
From what we understand, there are provisions in that franchise agreement that state they're supposed to bargain in good faith.
Well, then what are our elected officials doing about this?
Well,
I hear a pregnant pause.
Well, Mayor de Blasio has stated that he was willing to work with us and was going to reach out to the company. Governor Cuomo, the same thing, and same thing with the city council. We're still waiting on a hearing from a May meeting that was at the city council at the borough hall. And we wanted to prove to them that they were using out-of-state workers. We provided them with the information that there were at least 12 to 13 contractors from out-of-state. We've given them the pictures, and we've yet to hear back. And we're talking 9 months ago, 8 months ago.
Right, because that's one of the stipulations of the franchise
yes.
agreement.
They can use a certain amount of out-of-state contractors as the business needs to keep their business going, but they can't surpass that amount, and they have gone way and above. They're still actually housing out-of-state contractors in some of the hotels in Queens, and I think this is just ludicrous.
Well, it strikes me as pretty strange that they don't have enough money to pay health care, but they certainly have enough money to put advertising on television, because every time I turn my television on, there's this big thing flashing about Spectrum, $29.95 when bundled, $29.95 when bundled. So I guess it's easy to lower your prices that low when you're not paying your workers anything.
That's right.
Well, I think the big issue now, 10 months into the strike, is Spectrum's MO. You don't talk to your workers. You don't talk to the media. I guess you're not talking to elected officials. Where is the stick that somebody can take to Spectrum? Because we do have these public franchise agreements, and this is a chartered corporation. So, they can't work in a vacuum. I mean, they seem to be doing it so far, but they shouldn't be allowed to be working in a vacuum.
Well, what we're pushing for right now is for people of the city, the customers, the subscribers, to realize that this is a town where we negotiate in good faith. You don't want these people coming into your homes who aren't vetted, who aren't trained, coming from out of state. There were a few issues early on in the strike where they were bringing their weapons from Texas because they didn't realize they didn't have to check them at the door. And there were a few issues that came up with that. Fortunately for the city, the leadership of the company got to the bottom of that and they stopped that. So that's better for our customers. But at the end of the day, all we want to do is get back to the job that we do, taking care of the people of this city, reaching out to our communities, but we can't get the message out there. We've had a media block since day one. The only real type of media coverage we got was from Rosanna Scotto, who has been really supportive of all the workers, but we can't get any traction. We can't get human interest stories out there. We have members who have lost their homes. We have members who have lost their cars. We have members whose families had to split up to go live in different locations because no one family member can put them up. So we have a lot of human interest stories that nobody's touching on.
And when you say a media block, are you saying that you've reached out to these stations to try to have conversations with them and they just won't talk to you?
They don't want to have anything to do with it. I believe they're handcuffed by the company. Because if we're on your cable network and we have a contract with you, there's got to be some sort of written words that they can't bash the company. They can't speak negatively. We don't want you to speak negatively. We just want you to report a story.
Spectrum's a giant corporation. All the media outlets, all giant corporations. Folks, we got to wake up. We don't have a free press. We have a corporate press, and you got to support outlets like this. And because you're not going to get the news any other way. Tell us about how long you worked at the company and what you're going through now.
29 years. I mean, I thought this was going to be the career. I guess I'm going to have to continue on and look for something else. But, it's been hard. It's hard on the family. The bills continue. They're relentless. Bills knocking on the door every month. And that just doesn't stop. And, I got to provide for my family. And I also got to look for their, ahead for their future. And like they said, they wanted to give us a pension plan with the 401k. If that thing tanks, like the housing bubble, when everything just dropped out on us, I can't invest my future, my family's future, in something like that, where the union has a defined pension plan and medical plan, which, to me, that would secure my future.
And Spectrum knows this too, Bill, that being out this long is causing a lot of dissension. People want to hang together. You want to be in solidarity. But families under tremendous stress.
Yeah, the economic pressure is always the edge. Now, I'm just curious. Does anybody at this table have any idea what the CEO of Spectrum earns in a year?
$98 million.
$98 million. So there's probably a little bit something in the pot.
Oh, yeah.
Now, I was just reading the other day where I think it was it Washington? Was it Washington State where they came out with local legislation that said there wouldn't be any city contracts? Wouldn't be any city contracts for anybody that had more than 100-to-1 ratio.
That's a great piece of legislation.
Of CEO pay to average worker pay. And if I might be so bold to ask, what is the average wage, if you can do it, of a Spectrum worker? What kind of money are we talking about here?
If you're a journeyman, you're looking at about 80, maybe 80,000.
Okay.
So, all right. Middle class job.
So it's a middle class job. $80,000, $80,000 a year with a dignified retirement, mm-hmm. and health care for your family. And this is for something that gets somebody who gets up every day, puts their work clothes on, and goes out to work and services the public.
That's it. To make the people happy, they pay the bills.
So this is not. So we're not talking about anything ridiculous. What we need to do, fellas, Joe, John, Randy, we need to smash some of these myths about how overpaid and fat we union workers are. Right? I mean, we're talking about decent jobs for decent people who put in a decent day's work.
Yes, sir. That's all it's about.
All right. Well, fellas, thank you so much for being here. We're going to have you back. We're going to keep track of this story. It's an important story. Spectrum really shouldn't be able to get away with this. And there's no media block for you guys here on Blue Collar Buzz.
And like I said,
that's for sure.
They said wage. I mean, like they were saying about how they were offering this package. Now, if the package was that good and we felt this was something that was really good for everybody, we wouldn't be out for 10 months.
There you go. And we're gonna leave it at that, fellas. And thanks so much for being here. But we'll be back in just a second with more good talk on Labor Press's Blue Collar Buzz right here on AM 970, The Answer.
You're listening to Labor Press on AM 970, The Answer. We now return to Labor Press's Blue Collar Buzz with your hosts, Bill Holfeld and Joe Maniscalco.
I'll keep working my way back to you, babe, with a burning love inside.
And we're back with more good talk right here on Labor Press's Blue Collar Buzz. I'm your host, Bill Holfeld. In the studio with me is my co-host and producer, Joe Maniscalco. Joe, who do we have up next?
Well, right now, we're gonna talk to Mike Halpern from the International Union of Elevator Constructors, Local 1. And unfortunately, Bill, as you know, the deaths in the construction industry have continued this month. And we're going to talk about what steps we can take to try to stem the tide.
Okay, well, Mike, welcome back to the program. You've been here before, and it's always nice to see you.
Well, thank you for having me, Bill.
And, but tell us what. Now, I just read in the paper just recently, on that Sam Chang job, there was another death just recently.
Yeah, last week an elevator mechanic fell to his death. It's our understanding from talking to some folks who used to work with that employer that they don't provide any education and training, and oftentimes the workers have to buy their own safety equipment, and it's really just not a good environment to work safely in.
And as a matter of fact, I just recently wrote an editorial on that about having a culture of safety on the job, that nothing changes unless it's top-down that way.
Absolutely, and that's one of the reasons why we've been really trying hard to pass elevator safety legislation in New York State, as is already in place in some 35 other states. It will establish a culture of safety in this industry, not only for the worker, but for the elevator riding public as well.
So you're trying to tell me that there are 35 states that are ahead of New York? That bothers me.
Absolutely. In fact, as far as having qualifications to be an elevator or an escalator mechanic, New York is tied for dead last.
Dead last. So in other words, we make people go through more effort, time, and trouble to get a license to polish your nails or cut your hair than we do to build an elevator?
Yes, that is true. There are many trades, many jobs that require licensing. To be an elevator or an escalator mechanic in New York State, it requires zero education and training. And it's insane because in New York City and in New York State, we've got the tallest, the fastest, and, you know, as far as elevator are concerned, this is like the state-of-the-art city. You have elevators in this town and in this state that run at over 20 miles an hour with quarter-inch clearances, and you really need, like, precision as well as a skill set that includes, you know, a portion of the skill set of the electrician, a portion of the skill set of the iron worker, a portion of the skill set of the carpenter, and a portion of the skill set of a steam fitter or plumber. So you've got all of this highly technical stuff boiled into one trade, and you've actually got folks attempting it without education and training.
And of course, you know, it's New York. We have these high-tech elevators, but we also have these aging old elevators that also have to be taken care of. So the range of knowledge that you need to take care of these things is huge.
Yeah, absolutely. To be proficient as an elevator mechanic in this city, particularly as a maintenance mechanic, you need to be up to date on what was state-of-the-art 75 years ago as well as what's state-of-the-art today.
Well, I know you guys play a very active role in that, meaning the elevator constructors, because, I mean, I know you've got a really difficult apprenticeship program that you make everybody go through so that they have those skills.
Absolutely. And the standard for education and training is that standard or its equivalent. And that's what's required in the other states that have elevator licensing programs. And the bill would also call for mandatory elevator inspections, which in the city of New York, elevator inspections are done fairly regularly and fairly well. But there are pockets of the state where elevator inspections often go undone or there's no real regulation on it.
You know, it's funny because, as you were describing the clearances and the speeds that the elevators travel at and through, I was thinking to myself, that's one of those things we do, right, on an everyday basis, especially if you live in New York, you get in and out of elevators all the time, and you do it unthinking and not really very conscious or very aware of how much precision, which is the word you used, precision construction had to go into that.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, you know, most folks, and it should be this way, when you get on an elevator, you know, you just want to press your floor, I'm going to floor 5, let me press 5 and I'm going to get there. And you should be able to do that safely and confidently. Of late in New York, that's not the case. There are, you know, a number of elevator passenger fatalities. In fact, we had a 14-month period back in 2015, 2016, where there were 7 elevator passenger deaths, which is like unheard of. That would be like a 20-year norm. And in all of those deaths, the maintenance contractors of record do not provide the type of education and training for their mechanics that we're talking about in this legislation.
So tell me exactly, the meat and potatoes of what you want in this legislation. That's part one of the question. And part two is, what the heck is the block to this? Because this sounds like a common sense no-brainer.
And we hear that it's a common sense no-brainer every day as we walk through the legislature in Albany. So the meat and potatoes is the bill would set a minimum education and training standard for an elevator mechanic. It would be a 4-year training. It would include on-the-job training hours as well as classroom training. So you would learn over the course of 4 years. You would learn the basic construction of an elevator. You would learn basic electricity. You would learn circuit tracing. And you would learn solid state. And these are all the knowledge that you need to be successful as an elevator mechanic and to be proficient as an elevator mechanic. So that would be it, as well as on-the-job training over those 4 years, too. The block to it is the Real Estate Board of New York is opposing. Rebney is opposing.
Rebney strikes again, Joe.
Rebney strikes again.
They are opposing the legislation, and it's amazing because, like, I know there are cases where building superintendents have died going trying to fix an elevator or going to retrieve a set of keys out of the elevator pit. So it's like, you know, their people are in harm's way, too. So
how many years has this legislature been in the mix? It was like 5 or 6 years?
It's actually a little longer than that. We've been attempting this legislation for 8 years, and in all 8 years, we get a little closer to getting there.
This past year was the closest you've gotten, right?
This past year was the closest we've gotten. I mean, right now, the legislation enjoys some 45 co-sponsors in the New York State Senate, as well as over 70 in the Assembly. The legislation has passed the Assembly every year we've run it. It's yet to get through the New York State Senate.
So who in the Senate is getting a big fat paycheck from Rebney not to vote for this?
Well, I don't know that anybody's getting a paycheck not to vote for it, but the bottom line is Senate leadership doesn't put it on the floor, you know?
And I know you can't say that. I can't. I can get away with it, but it's okay. It's okay. That's why I'm here on this side of the mic.
Another big part of this, of course, the person that died most recently is Jukong Wu, an immigrant worker on a non-union site. Why? Because these developers can get immigrants to work for less. So it's a constant stream of, cheap labor. And let me just read what somebody tweeted out to us the other day. Sanctuary City, NYC, has now turned into mortuary city where immigrant construction workers come to die. Thank de Blasio.
Well, you know, let's be honest about it. When we talk about Rebney blocking this legislation or fighting this legislation, I mean, if we take the gloves off for a second, isn't it really so that we can give some free rein to non-union contractors? Because when you're talking about those standards of training, you're really talking about a good apprenticeship program that's been in place for many, many years.
You are. And the reason that's so problematic, though, is that, you know, for years, the elevator industry was, you know, a person would come into the industry and work for a company such as an Otis or a Schindler and learn the trade. And they might decide, you know what, I'm good at this. Let me take a go at it on my own, you know, and open up my own company, hang a shingle and stuff. What we're finding now, you know, that while that was the case 30 years ago, today's case is more like people are starting to realize that there's money in the industry and they're saying, you know what, let me use this as an investment opportunity. And they're coming in to the industry without the background, without knowing how critical the education and training is. And they're taking it upon themselves. You know what? Let me just go hire somebody from, you know, who knows how to fix cars and have them try to fix, you know, work on my elevators. And it's ludicrous. And they don't have the proper respect for the trade and the harm it can actually do to both a worker and to the elevator riding public. And that's why it's so important. And that's also why so many other states have put these standards in place, is they realize how technical the craft is, and also how you can be putting the public in harm's way if you don't put the elevators in the hands of trained people.
And you know, you use an interesting phrase there, right, which is what I always think the problem boils down to, which is respect for the trade. And we, you know, it's been a symptom in our culture recently that we don't have the same respect for the trades that we once did. And I mean, I don't know. I think about it when you were talking about the precision necessary for safety on elevators. I was thinking, well, how about an aircraft mechanic? Wouldn't you want, if you were going to go up in an airplane, wouldn't you want to know that that aircraft mechanic was properly trained, or a helicopter if you were going to go take a sightseeing tour? Why would you want to be any less safe on an elevator in a high rise?
Absolutely. And this is a similar form of transportation. While aircraft is a form of transportation, this is vertical transportation. This is what makes a vertical city possible. And the more cities keep going vertical, it's so important that this equipment be performed by trained mechanics. You know, it's really important that the installations and the maintenance are performed by trained mechanics.
So what do we need to do to get the Senate to get off the dime? What do we need to do?
I would say what we need to do to get the Senate to get off the dime is to put calls into Senate Leader John Flanagan and let him know that public safety should be second to nothing.
John Flanagan, now his position is what exactly?
He's the Republican leader of the New York State Senate.
He's the Republican leader. Okay, do we have a number? We have a number?
I don't have a number.
Okay,
with me.
All right. I just mean to put you on
tell
the spot.
Tell him it's the Elevator Safety Act.
The Elevator Safety. We're going to call. All right, everybody out there in Blue Collar Buzzland, I want everybody out there to pick up your phone. I want you to call John Flanagan in the New York State Senate and tell him that we want passage of the Elevator Safety Act. Have I got that right, Mike?
You have that right, Bill.
Mike, thank you so much for being on the program today. It is always a pleasure. Please come back and keep us apprised of the situation as it moves along.
Thank you very much, Bill, and thank you, Joe.
Thanks, Mike. Now we're going to switch it back over to Bill for a spotlight on American labor history.
On February 4th, 1896, delegates from independent ironworker locals from Chicago, New York, Pittsburgh, Cleveland, Buffalo, and Boston convened at Morehead Hall in Pittsburgh to organize the International Association of Bridge and Structural Ironworkers. In the late 1880s, steel had virtually replaced wood and stone is the primary load-carrying material in the erection of bridges and buildings. This abrupt change in structural materials brought about a demand for a new type of worker, the bridgeman, an architectural ironworker. Ironworkers became known as the cowboys in the sky. As these daring young independent men aged and became husbands and providers, their thoughts turned to providing for their families during sickness, injury, and death. And they realized that by joining together, their voices could become stronger, more unified, and heard. Thus, the International Association of Bridge and Structural Ironworkers of America was established. Today, 122 years later, that same proud organization exists, and its present name is the International Association of Bridge, Structural, Ornamental, and Reinforcing Ironworkers.
Thanks, Bill. That does it for another episode of Labor Press's Blue Collar Buzz. If you like us, follow us on Twitter at Labor Press NY, and visit our website at laborpress.org, and follow us on Facebook. And tune in next week for more Blue Collar Buzz here at AM 970, The Answer.